Welcome to Open Air. I'm Peter Robinson, this week standing in for David Latulli. And in our upcoming programme of the arts and cultural events happening here in San Francisco, we're going from Wagner and the Ring to an international art festival. And we even have more on the way with an orchestra, a special children's orchestra, and much, much more. So my first guest today, I want to welcome Kip Kroner to tell us a little bit about the production of The Ring, which opens on June the 12th at the War Memorial Opera House, and it runs through the month of June, finishing on July the 1st. Welcome to the studio, Kip.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to be here. Yes, we are preparing to do three cycles of Wagner's monumental Ring. The Ring of the Nibelung is the official full title. It's four operas that go together. It comes way before the Lord of the Rings, but it's the same idea of a number of pieces that go together, stretched over six days each cycle. And we're in rehearsal now, and it's going to open and take the city by storm, we hope. It's really selling well, so there's a lot
of
excitement.
Well, let's start with a piece of music anyway, and let's hear what we have. Now, just in case anyone thinks they're listening to Apocalypse Now, I want you to put this in the Wagner context, if you would.
That's right. This music now in the popular imagination is sort of indelibly connected with helicopters, but it is actually from the second of the four operas in The Ring, The Valkyrie. And the Valkyries are these warrior maidens that fly through the air and gather up fallen heroes from the battlefield and take them to Wotan's fortress of Valhalla, Wotan, the head of the gods, of course. And the music we were listening to comes from that scene where they're flying in and doing all this and having a wonderful time, rip-roaring time as they do that.
Good. Well, for a second, just for listeners who may not be totally familiar with the full Ring cycle, why not give us a little storyline on how the Ring reveals the story?
Yes, it's a monumental saga told in these four segments, but in brief, it really deals with the end of the world and the promise of a new beginning after the current situation goes away. Literally, the downfall of the gods due to mistakes and greedy errors that were made early on, the theft of gold from the Rhine, which represents pure, pristine nature, and there's an inexorable curse that results from that. And out of this ultimate downfall, we get the promise of a rebirth.
And this particular production has been done previously. Was it in Washington?
It has been done in Washington, but before that, here. In fact, all of these four productions have been done in both places. We started in a partnership with the Washington National Opera at the Kennedy Center, and doing each of these operas by itself, starting in Washington, then here. Ultimately, we did the whole cycle in 2011. Washington finally did it in 2016, the first time a Ring had ever been produced in D.C. locally. We've done it here many times. And now we're bringing it back with a different cast in the main roles and some changes visually. I think it'll be interesting to see how it's evolved.
And the set, when you come in, what will you expect to see on stage?
This is an American Ring, meaning that the images are evocative of American settings, things that we in America would recognize. The beginning of the first opera, The Rheingold, starts in what we would think of as the gold country, where this iconic gold is stolen, forged into a ring that gives its owner power over the universe. A curse is put on the ring, and so forth. We see a scene in the second opera of the cycle, The Valkyrie, which will really be reminiscent of Trump Tower. It shows great power and might.
Trump has found his way in.
Yes. Of course, remember that the design for this cycle goes way back to the 2006, I think it was, so before our current political situation. And we'll see other images that I think will be recognizably American as we watch this sort of gradual decay of nature and the corruption of our society ending with this downfall.
And in terms of cast, this is a pretty hefty cast, to put it bluntly. How many people?
It is. There are more than 35 named roles in the cycle. But, of course, we double some of them up. So you might sing one role in Rheingold and then come back and sing something else in Siegfried, which is the third opera of the cycle, or in The Twilight of the Gods, which is the fourth. But we have an international cast of top Wagnerians doing this. And in the three principal roles, we have people who have not done it here before. That's exciting. Geir Grimsley sings Wotan for us, and Swedish soprano Irene Terin comes in to do Brunhilde, who's the heroine of the whole
Absolutely,
cycle,
yes.
The savior of it all. And Daniel Brenna sings Siegfried, who is the hero.
And just in terms of the orchestra, how big is the orchestra?
It's immense. I think about 89 players. It's about as many as we can fit into the orchestra. And it includes some special instruments. Wagner wanted something in the brass area that would sort of blend between the trombones and the French horn. So he created an instrument called a Wagner tuba. And we have four of those in addition to everything.
Does it look like a regular tuba?
It looks like a baritone horn. If anyone who played in a high school band knows what a baritone horn looks like, it's similar.
Okay, it certainly gets your attention. How about
it does,
that?
Indeed.
Now, let's hear another piece of music. What have you chosen for us?
Let's listen to something romantic. This is from the first act of The Valkyrie, and this is our soprano Sieglinde, who has met her brother for the first time since they were little kids. They were separated, Siegmund, and they're falling in love. It's actually romantic love between these siblings. This is opera, after all. Mm-hmm. And she sings to him, "You are the springtime that has come to me in the cold winter of my unhappiness."
That's a great image, isn't it? Yeah. So if you can go to number two, please. Button, as they say.
Well, that's all right. We instead of listening to that romantic soprano aria, this was a little bit of Wotan's aria at the end of the first opera, Rheingold, where he's singing the praises of his magnificent new castle, Valhalla. But let's listen to this. This is number six, actually, in our selections here. This is the romantic, "You Are the Springtime in the Winter of My Discontent."
Yeah, very, very romantic. Is that a direct translation, "The Winter of My Discontent"? Or?
Well, no, that's Steinbeck, of course, but okay. It's very similar sort of
I'm
meaning
thinking
there.
Of Richard III and "The Summer of My Discontent." Anyhow, let's also talk a little bit about how the story progresses, because it's always the last act that kind of brings everything together. So what would they find in the final opera?
Right. In the final opera, things get very human. We've been dealing with gods and dwarves and giants and so forth up to that point. But now we get into a sort of a complicated love quadrangle, if you will. Our hero, Siegfried, who is beautifully matched up with Brunhilde, is tricked through a potion to forget all about her, and he marries Gutruna, and Brunhilde is forcibly married off to Gutruna's brother Gunther, so it's all terribly embroiled there. Ultimately, Siegfried is killed out of jealousy. He's a victim of the curse that is on this ring that everyone covets, along with many others who fall victim to this curse. And it's Brunhilde that steps in at the end, and in a sacrificial act, she burns herself on Siegfried's funeral pyre, returns the ring to its pristine home in the Rhine, kind of restoring nature to its original state, and allowing for the promise of a new beginning. Meanwhile, the gods have burned up and they're all gone.
So it's a tragic, sad ending. Somebody wins, somebody loses, but nature ultimately triumphs.
Exactly, and there's hope for something new and maybe a starting over and getting a better outcome the second time.
Okay, now assuming we get the numbers right this time, what is the...
This is going to be number 4 in our selections, and this is the tenor aria that also comes from the first act of the Valkyrie, and the tenor, again, singing to his sister, but it's a romantic piece here. It's called Winterstürme, and it's the winter storms have passed, and it's time now for springtime and love.
Leuchtet der Lenz auf linden Rift, leicht und lieblich, wunderwebend hier sich legt. Durch Wald und Wahlen weht sein Atem, weit geöffnet lacht sein Aug, das
I should mention that's Brandon Jovanovic as Siegmund. He's doing it again for us this time around. These are recordings from back in 2011 when we did this. And the soprano that we heard just a moment ago was Anya Kempa.
And I've noticed in these interesting selections that you've offered, we've been looking really at the elements, at nature, at springtime, at different seasons. So we can speak about the gods, but also just in terms of our own recognition of the environment and the ecology movement, there is a kind of connection in what Wagner's putting together.
Absolutely. And our director for this production, Francesco Zambello, has focused on that. The idea that heedless acts of greed greed and destruction, they set in force these inexorable forces of doom, and it's a life lesson for our own time.
And it's a kind of contrast between the material and the spiritual, because I find a lot of this music, you know, hits you at a kind of gut emotional level where the words are important, but the music is important too.
Absolutely. In fact, Wagner recognized that when he got to the very end of writing the cycle. He tried various endings in terms of his script. He wrote the words himself. But he eventually abandoned that all to the music. He thought, okay, we're going to see the gods burn up and Brunhilde sacrificed and so forth. But then I'm going to let the music tell us about what happens next and about this dawning promise of a new age.
So the huge cast and the huge orchestra are going to be in full volume like any good Wagner production.
That's right. It's 17 hours in the theater and counting intermissions, and it's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime experience for anyone who hasn't already had it.
And so just to repeat, it opens on June the 12th. It runs through until the beginning of July. It's at the War Memorial Opera House, and it really sounds like a great showing and a great gift to San Francisco to be able to bring this. It's an expensive experience, I imagine.
It is. It's a big undertaking. It taxes every element of the opera company, but we're up to it, and we're looking forward to the challenge.
Well, thank you, Kip, for coming into the studio today. And just one more time, The Ring opens on June the 12th, running to the beginning of July at the Opera House, the War Memorial Opera House. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Great to be here.
Okay. Something completely different. We're going to be talking about Emily Dickinson. My guest is Stephen Herman, and his new book Emily Dickinson, a medicine woman for our times. And we all need a little bit of medicine occasionally. Why not go with Emily Dickinson? Stephen, welcome to KLW.
Thank you, Peter.
So we know her as a poet. We know her as a healer. But you also use the word shaman as one of the descriptions for her. So let's start with that. Mm. What is that concept of healing that you found in your new book?
Well, the characterization of Emily Dickinson as a medicine woman or a shaman is derived from her poetry and her letters directly. She speaks of ecstasy, for instance, Peter, and ecstasy, according to the authority on shamanism, Mircea Eliade, is a technique of ecstasy. She has method or technique that she uses in her lines, in her poetry, in her rhythm, that brings one to this state of mind you could call an ecstatic state. And one of her last poems, "Take all away from me, but leave me ecstasy, and I am richer than all my fellow men." This is an example of what I mean by a shaman poet or a medicine woman, someone who transmits this kind of transcendent state of awareness to the reader or listener through the hearing of the poem.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite poems, written in 1861, which begins, "I am nobody, who are you?"
Yes.
"Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell one's name, the lifelong June, to a admiring bog." And one reason I really like this, we have the cult of personality today.
Yes.
And in many ways, although she lived both in her cottage and in her garden, she is a withdrawing person.
Yes.
Which is really, I think, what we could use much more today than some of the celebrities. So how do you feel about this poem?
Oh, I love the poem. It speaks to her personality. She sought solitude. The soul selects her own society, then shuts the door to her divine majority, present no more. This idea that she was ironically a nobody, Peter, this was asked 60 years before women were granted the right to vote. So the fact of her anonymity was very painful for her. She published 7 poems in her lifetime out of 1,775. Yeah. So this was both a tragedy, but also something that I think empowered her in her own way, too.
So she, again, like many artists, gets late recognition yes. after her death. Mm-hmm. Now let's talk, I know you're also a therapist, mm-hmm. about these various diagnoses, that she was a loner, she was a recluse.
Yes.
How do you see that part of her life?
Oh, I think that this is unacceptable to diagnose her with modern psychiatric diagnoses. Also, shamans were diagnosed as epileptics in the 19th century by modern anthropologists. This also was unacceptable. I mean, Emily Dickinson was not the recluse she's made out to be. She was not the loner who spent all of her time in her room. She spent an equal amount of time in her garden. She was a baker. She baked for her entire family. She had many friends. Wrote many letters. She was voluminous in her letter writing. She's not the schizotypal personality that even some psychoanalysts, modern-day psychoanalysts, have diagnosed her with, which I think is unacceptable.
Now, let's focus on the garden, because to me the garden and the images from the garden mm-hmm. often speak loud, mm-hmm. the birds singing, the flowers. And on the healing side of things, she mentions rosemary.
Oh, yes.
And I think some of the herbal shops nowadays also mention rosemary.
Right. In her poem, Essential Oils, she mentions the attar being wrung from the rose. And then she goes on to say, "But this in lady's drawer makes summer when the lady lie in ceaseless rosemary." So this idea of the rosemary being something she would be buried in her coffin, actually was a fact. And rosemary's been known to have medicinal healing uses. It's used to boost memory, to increase the amount of oxygen to the brain, mm-hmm. And used in certain remedies for various viruses and that kind of thing.
And another thing I take from not just her, but from poetry in general, I remember after the sad and tragic bombing of the Twin Towers, I found mm-hmm. myself reading a poem by W.H. Auden mm-hmm. called September 1939, mm-hmm. and I got a great deal of solace from that. Mm-hmm. And when I think of one of her poems, this was written in 1863. Mm-hmm. It begins, "Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. Mm-hmm. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. Mm-hmm. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I have put away my labor and my leisure, too, for his civility." Mm. And I think one thing I take from hers is that she has these short poems, but there is a majestical slowness to them that really speaks about the pace of life mm-hmm. and how one of my bête noires is in our high-tech mm-hmm. age, we all live too fast. Mm. How do you feel about the rhythm within her poems?
Oh, I love the rhythm. It's very much a slow pace, and this is what she describes as they pass in the carriage by a school where children strove in recess at the ring. She sees the children playing. She sees the setting sun. But then at the end, she says, "Peter, but the horses' heads were toward eternity." And this idea of lying in ceaseless rosemary was the immortality I think she felt that she was going to eventually achieve as a poet, an American poet who had written 800 poems and in 40 packets carefully sewed them together in these fascicles, 40 fascicles, that were found by her sister Lavinia after her death and published posthumously after her passing.
I think, too, she does speak about hope. In fact, there is another poem written in 1861. Mm-hmm. Hope is the thing with feathers, mm-hmm. the perches in the soul, the sings that tune without the words and never stops at all. To me, I get a lot of hope from her poems.
Oh, yes. You know, the element of hope is so powerful and so important psychologically. She was also a very great religious poet. She grew up in a situation where there was a conflict between the Trinitarians in Amherst and the Calvinist organization and the Unitarians of Boston, the liberal Unitarians. And it's out of that schism that she developed what I think is a form of spiritual democracy of her own, that she arrived at a place of unity between world religions where this hierarchical or patriarchal look at religion through the monotheisms was transcended through nature, through the discoveries in science, the discoveries of Alexander von Humboldt in his book Cosmos, and of her teacher at Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, the Reverend Edward Hitchcock, who was the founder of the American Association of Geologists. So she studied science. She's the most scientific of the 18th century poets.
And I think in some ways she actually transcends religion. I take a spiritual message from what she's talking about.
I agree. And this is why I use the term spiritual democracy, because she's transcending any kind of organized faith. Faith is a fine invention, she says, when gentlemen can see. You know, this idea that microscopes were prudent, as she said, in an emergency. She was in an emergency, what we would call today in the parlance of the DSM-4-5, a spiritual or religious crisis and or a spiritual emergency. The emergency was, as a very powerful feminist poet, her poems were not being recognized and published. And this is what helped her, I think, in some way become the poet she is today.
Yes, you're listening to KLW. I'm speaking to author Stephen Herman. His new book, Emily Dickinson, A Medicine Woman for Our Times. So tell me, you kind of came to this book over what sounds like a reasonably long period of time.
Oh,
it's
yes.
A book which grows on you.
Oh, yes, 23 years. In 1995, I wrote my first 70-page essay on her. And I put this in my desk drawer and published books on William Everson, the California poet in Santa Cruz who I worked with as a teaching assistant, as well as a book on Walt Whitman, Herman Melville. And Emily Dickinson required a book of her own. So it's published now. It was published on March 21st of this year, 2018, by Fisher King Press. It's a Jungian publishing house. I'm a Jungian psychotherapist, so I use a Jungian analytical framework or Jungian criticism to look at her poetry from the standpoint of the unconscious, from the psyche, and what she was trying to do to transform American poetry from its roots up, which means from the shamanistic ground of her experience.
And you have, apart from ones we've talked about, a favorite Emily Dickinson poem of your own?
Oh, sure. I have a number, but I could read one, I think.
Oh, yes, please do.
Wild Nights. Wild Nights. Were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury. Futile the winds to a heart in port. Done with the compass, done with the chart. Rowing in Eden, ah, the sea. Might I but more tonight in thee?
I always think a wild night is, for Emily Dickinson, something different to a wild night for me, but I like the sea imagery and the way of finding calmness amongst the waves.
Yes.
And I think that's what she's talking about.
I think she is. I think she... and we don't want to discount the wildness. There is a wildness in her poetry as well, a certain kind of violence. She spoke of herself as a still volcano and identified herself with Vesuvius. And
she's also writing during the time of the American Civil War.
Oh, yes, she is. And she has poems referring to this. Her liberty being chained and breaking the bounds of, you could say, slavery. But this was breaking out of the shackles of sexist oppression. This was her feminist rebellion that was happening simultaneously with the poem you read was about the time of the Emancipation Proclamation. So she's writing during this time in the nation and writing out of this time with a kind of timeless message that I think is speaking to us now.
Now, you're going to be doing a reading at Book Passage in Sausalito.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Next Thursday evening at 6 p.m., the 31st of May. I'll be speaking and signing books at the Sausalito Book Passage, yes.
Yeah, and just a quick plug. I think Book Passage is a good example of an independent bookstore that really does bring everyone from chefs to authors to poets to writing workshops, three branches, one in Corte Madera, one where you'll be in Sausalito,
yes.
And then one at the Ferry Building. Mm-hmm. So the book we've been talking about today, Emily Dickinson, A Medicine Woman for Our Times, by Stephen Herman, and he will be in Sausalito next week. So, Stephen, thank you very much for coming in
today.
Thank
you, Peter. Yeah.
welcome Andrew Wood, the director of the San Francisco International Arts Festival.
Hello.
And we've just got a whole variety of things, from music to dancing, everything under the sun, I think, as far as I can tell.
We try to do quite a range of different types of performing arts. We have this week we have comedy, music, performance art, and dance. And next week we're adding circus to the mix as well, and theatre. So there's quite a lot. There's 40 different artists from 7 different countries in the Bay Area.
And this is taking place?
We start tonight. We're May the 24th through June the 3rd at the Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture, multiple different venues.
And what does the circus involve? That sounds
the
like...
circus, we have two women's circuses. Circus is a very male-dominated art form. And so what I wanted to do was bring in two companies that are led by women, that are all women companies, that that really speak with a different feminist voice. And so we have Cirque Antique coming from Montreal, and we have Troupe Vertigo coming from Los Angeles. And the Los Angeles company are run by a woman called Aloysia Gavre, who used mm-hmm. to be she's from San Francisco, and she got her start in the Pickle Family Circus before she found fame and fortune with Cirque du Soleil, and then she started her own company in Los Angeles.
And when we think about Cirque du Soleil or the whole Pickle family, we're talking about physical acts, jumping
yes.
up and down.
Yeah, there's
trapezes,
no animals.
No this animals.
It's all acrobatics, trapeze. And the two companies are very different. I mean, Cirque Antique, it's more like a burlesque cabaret, whereas Aloysia's work with Troupe Vertigo, it's much more aligned with modern dance, and it's more earthy. So even though they're both speaking about women's rights, they're doing it in very different ways. So you can compare and contrast the two.
Okay. Now, tomorrow, if I've got it right, Friday, we have with us the conductor or the bandmaster of the Orchestra Gold, part of this festival, Erev Hakma. Can you tell us a little bit about the music we're likely to hear?
Sure. So tomorrow night, we're going to take a trip back to the 60s era, independence era, Mali, and listen to some of what they would call orchestra music. In Mali, using that term orchestra, they're not referring to orchestra in the Western sense of the word. They're referring to Malian folkloric music being played on Western instruments. So you're likely to hear normal Western instruments that you would see in another ensemble, such as bass, guitar, and drums. The only thing is they're playing ancient music that sometimes stems back from generations, maybe even hundreds of years ago.
And you've actually brought an example of that type of music with you. So we're going to hear a little piece which Eric will be leading the band in tomorrow with.
I sure am. I'm going to play this right now. So this song is called Jama, and this song is actually a rendition of an old folkloric song that was very popular in Mali in the 80s by a singer named Karamogo Keta, who Malians affectionately refer to as Karasho. So I'm going to play it first, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what they're saying.
And Eric will be explaining it. So what are they actually singing about in this particular folk piece?
So this particular song is calling us as listeners to not get caught up in the isolation of our own singular worries. It's to encourage us to get close to those people who love us, our friends, our family, and to spend time with them and let us enjoy their uplifting presence with us. Much of the music from this era was coming from a place where music wasn't just used to please people. It was about advising people. It was about showing them what was right and what was wrong. It was about introducing them to these eternal wisdoms. And so all of the songs that we play come from that era. And the hope is for us that now in this time where we're kind of surrounded by all this technology and things are moving quickly, as you were talking about earlier, Peter, that we can still look to some of these lessons, some of these examples, some of these messages from our past that will help cue us as to our current predicaments.
And so music is bringing people together with a sense of history, and at the same time, it could be educational if you're talking about lessons to learn. And how did you get involved in this type of music?
So I got involved in this type of music randomly. I did an internship in Mali in 2006. Our singer, Mariam Jakite, is sitting in the corner for all the listeners out there, and I met her that same year. So I've been studying Malian music for about 12, 13 years now, going back and forth. And we had the idea to start this band about 2 or 3 years ago, and that's where the San Francisco International Arts Festival kind of kicked in. I met Andrew last year and was telling him about what we were doing, and the San Francisco International Arts Festival was sort of the capstone event that led us to kind of continue our partnership that we had created in Mali here in the States.
Good, and you're going to be playing tomorrow, Friday. Is that from 8 till 8 p.m. or is it 8 p.m.? Is that when you're performing?
7 p.m.
7 p.m. Thank you, Andrew. Yeah. It's a tight timeline there, 7 to 8 p.m. And we are playing in Gallery 308, as Andrew mentioned, at the Fort Mason Center for the Arts in San Francisco.
And let's go back to you for a second, Andrew, because I'm just looking at the range of this. Just to give you some of the headings: cirque, comedy, dance, music, performance arts, theatre. Anything missing?
We haven't got opera in this year.
But, okay. You know, but, so when you put something together like this, how long does it take to get a program as diverse as this going?
It takes between 2 and 3 years to do each one. Mm-hmm. And so we know what we want to do next year now. We're just waiting for all the funding to come in. And so we'll know by November how much we have. And so when I go out on the road, so I'll be heading to Barcelona in July and then up to Canada. I'll be looking for 2020 by that time. And then with a lot of the local artists, it's all new work. So again, we're out raising money. You have to conceive of the idea. You have to go and raise the cash. Then you have to make the piece. And a lot of the times they premiere at the festival. But it takes a couple
and
of years to
do. Let's just give the website if you want to get people calling in or looking for what's
right.
on.
www.sfiaf.org.
And this includes comedy, and I know it includes a lady who's with us today, and she's going to tell us a little bit about how her particular act fits into this very, very interesting and diverse program. So, welcome. Tell us who you are and tell us what you're doing.
Hi, my name's Yvette DeBose. I'm a performance artist. This is my first time ever talking on radio, so I'm very nervous and I'm going to blather
a lot.
Well,
I should say Yvette looks great here. She has a magnificent orange bonnet on top.
Thank you. I love this bonnet.
And already has a smile that has endeared everybody here in the studio over to her. So in your comedy act, what type of things will you be doing?
So it's kind of in conversation with RuPaul's Drag Race. I don't know if you've ever watched that. It's a drag performance show done inappropriately by a white straight female, talking about issues of cultural appropriation done on behalf of white people, sensitive topics, but told in a very funny, absurdist, over-the-top kind of way, with all the pageantry that comes along with a drag show.
So it's satire, I think, essentially. Am I right in saying that?
You are not wrong.
I'm not wrong. I'd rather be right, but rather except for not being wrong. Now, you know, I've often thought of satire as exposing some truths, but with a sting in the tail. Do you have a sting in your tail?
I think the whole thing is kind of a sting in the tail aimed back at myself and aimed at all white women who kind of think that they're making a difference or want to defend themselves as, oh, I'm not part of the problem.
Are you part of the solution?
I hope this show is part of the solution. I genuinely do. This is a topic I really care about and have worked really hard to find a way to express in a productive way, but in a way that's also, to me, productive comedy is something that talks about the truth in an honest way. That kind of includes yourself.
And where are you from originally?
San Diego.
Okay, so you've come north to enlighten San Francisco on what we should be thinking about when it comes to women. Is that right? Or are we going beyond women here?
I would say women of color, all people of color, but also kind of taking accountability on behalf of white women.
And tell me, Andrew, how did you find Yvette?
Well, the festival's a lot of different organizations working together, a lot of different presenters. And Yvette's been presented by Embark Arts, Embark Gallery, who are at Fort Mason Center. And so we work with different organizations at Fort Mason. But what's really important to us about Yvette's work is that she's part of a generation of younger artists who are thinking about making their work in different ways. She's graduated from College of the Arts?
California College of the Arts.
Right. And what's coming out of the campuses these days is quite different from what's been there before. And so we're very interested in that. We're actually going to have a presentation on Saturday morning. It's free to the public, free to people who are interested, about how we get people who are 1 to 5 years out of college with performing arts degrees into the festival, sponsored by their alma maters. And so on at 11 o'clock on Saturday in Gallery 308, we'll be having this presentation about how artists of Yvette's age can be in the festival on an ongoing basis in coming years.
Yeah, so this is a great opportunity for young people from college to actually put their act on stage.
Well, I think there's more performing arts degree programs now than there ever have been, but there's not more performance opportunities. Mm-hmm. So I think we're turning out a lot of graduates, and we're trying to figure out how do you provide earned income opportunities for these people? How do you provide exposure for these people to get their work out on the stage? But in also, I mean, at Fort Mason, we have lots of non-traditional venues. So we have galleries, we have empty hangars and things like that. And it's about putting non-conventional work into those spaces, or doing a lot of work with computers, doing a lot of work with artificial intelligence and all that kind of stuff. It's a new type of art that hasn't been done before. And I think part of our job as the festival is to put a lot of that out there, and have multiple artists of that generation performing, not just by themselves in isolation, but as part of a sort of peer group that can see each other's work and check each other out. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're doing on Saturday at 11 o'clock. It's a free presentation for anybody who's interested in being part of the festival, who's graduated from the performing arts programs in the Bay Area in the last 5 years.
And Yvette, just remind us, which studio are you going to be hanging out in?
I will be in the Southside Theater.
And how do you see the space that you're using? Because space is important.
It's very intimidating. It's definitely different from anything I've ever done before, because I've worked in gallery settings only. So you go from white walls to a black box, and having people stationed in front of you and you're delivering entertainment toward them versus being in a white wall gallery where people are kind of idling around and ignoring you or paying attention to you and then walking away. This is a new opportunity to keep people engaged for a total of like 60 minutes, which is very different for performance art, and I'm very excited.
Is that essentially a monologue for 60 minutes?
It would be if that's what I was doing.
But what are you doing then? That's not a monologue.
I would call it like a performative lecture. And if you've gone to an artist talk, a lot of times they have like a PowerPoint of their work, and they'll explain what it is that their process is and what they were thinking about when they made that. But it's all done with this satirical lens of this ironic character who is misappropriation, this drag queen wannabe, who's kind of just absurd and pathetic.
And what, because of the costume must be important, what will you be wearing?
I'm so glad you asked. I'm really excited about the costume. It is called the Aloha Kitty. It's inspired by a Starbucks-specific secret menu drink. And it's all pink. It's made out of vinyl. I made most of it. Vinyl and pink balloons. And then the headdress is made with several piñatas that I consider to be the whitewashed piñata variety.
Well, there we are, not only a performer, but a fashionista, and a headdress which would really fit in nicely at Beach Blanket Babylon, by the sound of things.
I desperately want to work for them.
So, Andrew, give us our dates one more time and our locations and how they can find out more about you.
Okay, we are opening tonight, Thursday, May the 24th, with three different music shows. One of them is already sold out, but we have Fana Fiala and Yohei Miyake from Japan. We run through June the 3rd. We're at the Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture, and our website is www.sfiaf.org, and our phone number is 415-399-9554.
Okay, thank you, Andrew, and thank you, Vet, for coming in today, and we all look forward to seeing, hearing, and experiencing the full impact. Going from Mali and Fort Mason to classical music. And David, tell us who you are and what you do.
Well, my name is David Ramadanov. I'm music director and conductor of Young People's Symphony Orchestra in Berkeley.
Good. And in fact, in next month over in the East Bay in Berkeley, you have a concert coming up at the Young People's Orchestra.
We have the final concert of our season, which actually kind of serves two purposes. Annually, we have always been sponsored for our final concert of the year by the Kiwanis of Berkeley, and we provide them with a Pops concert. But at the same time, it gives us an opportunity to pre-rehearse and prepare work that we have done earlier in the season that we are taking on our Northwestern tour.
And when we say young peoples, what's the range age of the orchestra?
Mostly middle school through high school, starting at age 12 or 13, going up to age 17. Occasionally we get one or two college members, and very rarely we might get an extremely talented 11 or 12-year-old.
And I think I'm right in saying that you've been involved with this orchestra since the 1980s?
I became music director in the 1988-89 season.
89. And the orchestra itself has a long history, in fact.
It's 81 years old. It was formed in 1936. It is the oldest youth orchestra in California, and it's the second oldest in the country.
Good. And so let's look a little at the upcoming concert. What pieces might we be likely to hear?
I'll talk a little bit, first of all, about some of the pieces we're doing on that concert that we'll also take on tour.
Okay.
We're going to do selections from Stravinsky's 1945 Firebird Suite and from Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. We're also going to be featuring a couple of young soloists who were winners in our annual concerto competition, and one of them will be performing on the tour as well. He's our tuba player, Riley Baker, who's a graduating senior this year, and he's going to do Ray Vaughan Williams' tuba concerto.
And I asked this question because we were talking about tubas early on in relation to Wagner. What sort of tuba is this one going to be?
This is a genuine bass tuba.
Okay. A lot of beef to go with it.
There is. However, it's interesting that the way that Vaughan Williams wrote for it, he doesn't treat it as a loud instrument or comic instrument. He writes it very lyrically for it. So there's some sensitive, very sensitive playing, and also some light, virtuosic, very quick playing as well.
And it must be difficult to play quick on the tuba, isn't
it? It is.
Yeah.
It
is. So we have dexterity of the fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other individual performer you mentioned.
Barbara Fairweather is also one of our seniors. She is a flutist. She's going to be playing the concertino by Cécile Chaminade, who is a forgotten composer and concert pianist was very prominent throughout the world, in Europe and in this country, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. She writes very attractive, easily accessible pieces of musical, which actually inspired the formation of Chaminade clubs in this country. Mm-hmm. But then eventually her music was eclipsed by more adventurous composers like Debussy and Ravel.
Mm-hmm. Now, separate to the concerts in June in the East Bay, your orchestra actually goes on tours at different places. Mm-hmm. So what's the upcoming tour?
The upcoming tour will be going to Seattle, where we will hear the Seattle Symphony in performance and then give a concert. And then we will actually have our members be coached by members of the Seattle Symphony, which is going to be a wonderful opportunity for them. From there, we go to Victoria, where we will spend 2 days. And by the way, most of our concerts we share with local orchestras. Victoria is the one exception, where we will be giving the concert completely on our own, doing Dvorak's Carnival Overture. Riley will be playing the Vaughan Williams Tuba Concerto on that program, and then the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony. And then we go to do 2 concerts in Vancouver.
Good. Now, you just mentioned Dvorak and Tchaikovsky. Should we hear a piece? What would you like to begin
this, with? This is the opening piece for several of our concerts. This is Dvorak's light and very, very dynamic Carnival Overture.
Will certainly get the audience awake. Let's talk a little bit about it.
Dvorak wrote this particular piece in the 1880s, and he really wanted to get the feeling of a carnival and a festival. The piece starts, as you've heard, but then it gradually settles down to a more beautiful, thoughtful, meditative middle section, and then he gradually works his way back into the music that began the piece. And very, very exciting.
And I know we talked earlier before you went on air that you've had some interesting examples of students who've studied in the orchestra and then later in life have gone on to something totally different, but they've learnt from that process.
Yes. Mm-hmm. June Park, who was one of our concert masters about 4 years ago, was an absolutely outstanding violinist who did a wonderful performance of the Prokofiev First Violin Concerto First Movement with us. She was one of our competition winners, and now she's a scientist, just finished her degree at MIT. Another remarkably talented young man, Joshua Herman, was multi-talented on the cello and on piano. He was my principal cellist the particular season I'm thinking of, but he also twice won our concerto competition on piano, for playing the first movement of the Grieg Piano Concerto and then the first movement of the Rachmaninoff Second Piano Concerto. He has since gone into international affairs.
So they've had a good exposure, just even on these tours alone. You're seeing different cities, different cultures. I think last year you were in Great Britain, I understand.
Yes.
And so they get a travel experience, a cultural experience, as well as a musical experience.
They do.
And as a conductor, I'm often interested in the role that conductors play just around the world, because they obviously have some impact both with and beyond the orchestra. So how do you view the role of the conductor?
You're thinking of the orchestra or the audience?
Both. Yeah.
Working with young people, I mean, in many cases, they're playing this music for the first time. Mm-hmm. And so it's a sense of giving them what the composer was about when he was writing this music. How does it fit in a historical context? What's the emotional message that the composer is trying to communicate? And we try to introduce that to them on several levels. In addition to the work that they do with me, my players also work with 10 coaches. 5 string coaches, a woodwind coach, a horn coach, trumpet coach, a little brass coach, and percussion coach. And they help them learn something about the technical difficulties of playing the piece. So when they bring it to me, then I can show them how that all relates together. But then from there, build the aesthetic and also give them some of the history and some of the fun in the history behind the pieces that they're playing.
And I know you chose a second piece to hear today. What was that now?
Well, there are two pieces I had in mind that I would love to play for you, but I don't know if we have time for both of them.
No.
The one that I know we have the time for is the last movement of the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony, which is going to be one of the pieces that comes very close to the end of our Pops concert on June 10th, and will also be the closing work on the programs.
Good. Well, let's hear that first. We'll probably squeeze in a little bit of the other one as well. So that would take us out with a bang. I mean,
this is
a piece that you would finish with.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to squeeze in the other piece. So what was that you had in mind?
This will be a little bit of an anticlimax because it's a quiet, thoughtful piece.
Mm-hmm.
We are commissioning next year a work by a composer from Los Angeles named Jeremy Cavatera. But on this tour, one of the pieces that we're featuring is a movement from his Monterey Suite, which my other orchestra, the Master Sinfonia Chamber Orchestra, commissioned in 2013.
So it's a modern piece, then?
It is, but it won't sound all that modern.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremy loves the Monterey Bay Area, and so he wrote a multi-movement piece called the Monterey Suite.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular movement was just simply an idea of how would you describe the feeling of entering as you're driving along the Monterey Peninsula and just seeing some of the different sights as you're coming along. How do the moods and the colors strike you?
Mm-hmm. Now, this was written...
This was the Tchaikovsky Fourth Symphony.
Yeah, I realize that. But this piece we're going to hear now was written with a view of Monterey Bay and the whole surrounding area.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, before thank you for coming in, let's just get details if people want to come to the concert in the East Bay.
The concert will be on Sunday, January the 10th at 3 o'clock. It's going to be held in Oakland at the Greek Church of the Ascension on Lincoln Avenue, right near the Mormon Tabernacle.
And is there a website that we can go to?
The website is www.ypsomusic.org.
So we've been listening to about the Young People's Orchestra with David. I want to thank you very much for coming in today. And also reminding people that if they want to learn how to play an instrument, become part of an orchestra, maybe even go on tour, this is a great opportunity open to students when they've been auditioned and selected here in the Bay Area. And do you want to give us the website one more time?
Yes, www.ypsomusic.org.
Thank you.